Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'll just say quickly, this is part of a larger project, and I'll read you a much abbreviated paper. This project has no field, per se. Those who've spoken before me and many who will speak here today locate their work in a field, i.e. Dakar, Senegal, a village on the Mandé Plateau, and so on. This is, I think, an unlocatable project. Although I do hope to do field work, it is not in connection with Keita's images, and hopefully after you hear me today, you'll understand a bit more about why I think that would be impossible. I also wanted quickly to ask if people are familiar with Keita's work or have seen Keita's work. Yeah, okay. It's difficult to gauge. I always make these kind of grand shortcut gestures when I speak on him about his succès fou and the shows in Tokyo and Paris and, you know, Gagosian and Sean Kelly and so on. And then I realize I'm speaking to people who've never seen his work before. I didn't think that would be this clientele, but I wanted to ensure that there's a point of contact there. Okay. Dislocating freedom. I am not an art historian, and my interest in West African studio portraiture is not historical, at least not in a conventional sense. I come at these photographs rather with a view to thinking their ongoing intervention in what Okwie Nwaiser has helpfully called the global image ecology. Like my colleagues in art history, I believe it makes sense to speak of this material as constituting an archive as well as a tradition or traditions, in the sense that one finds references in the critical literature to West African studio portrait tradition. And I believe it is by no means incidental to the constitution of either tradition or archive that these photographs were taken in the immediate pre-independence era. My own preoccupation with these photographs, however, stems from a desire to think their present contribution to photography's alteration and reordering not only of history, but of human being. In the language of the call that brings us together here today, I will speak to you, offer you an analysis of a specific visual language that happens to be both African and modern. I will suggest that this language not only intersects, but at certain points actively disrupts a global discourse of modernity. This language is importantly also a photographic one, and I come at these photographs, and I will be speaking to you obviously about Keita's photographs today, in hopes of meditating a little on the futures, sometimes invisible to us, that they also carry. These photographs are for me historical, then, but not frozen or bound within the supposed finitude of the moment in which they were taken. And it is in connection less with some past they have recorded, a past, that is to say, that would stay in the past, dead and gone or behind us, than with something they have perhaps yet to show us, that I believe they speak most eloquently of freedom. I believe, with Walter Benjamin, that to think photography and to read a photograph in a way that would bring its history to light, we must think its relationship to the future. Every photograph has a relationship to the future that exceeds the intention or desire of either photographer or subject. The photograph's relationship to the future is never free in the sense of indeterminate or open-ended, but it is always shared and in a radical sense. And I believe it becomes possible to think on the basis of this very excess of photography to history, acts of transmission, communication, and communion that first become possible only with photography. The photograph's future cannot be closed off from any site or space, or indeed from any spectator. Ensuring that the meaning or power of intervention of a single photograph or photographic corpus cannot be confined to a given nation, people, culture, or circuit of circulation, to a given geography or a finished history. Hence the limitations obvious to us now of Eurocentric approaches to photography, but also the limitations, I would argue, no less sinister, if less often remarked, of those approaches that would confine the interpretation to non-European photographic materials, to area studies paradigms or identity politics models. In my recent research, from which this paper is drawn, I've begun to engage with the photographic portrait as a privileged site or place for thinking photography's power to transform and produce new forms of ethical and political relation communal belonging, and collective identity. One of the questions I have recently begun to explore is whether there is a technique or practice of portraiture adapted to the experience of the human being who has been left off the map of the neoliberal world order, a portraiture adapted to the being face or body that remains illegible within the visual and epistemological regimes of global capital. Is it possible, if you like, to speak of a neoliberal, or to borrow a term from Achille Mbembe, a necropolitical form of portraiture, as well as a modern or a democratic form? How to take a picture of the human being who is precisely not recognized as such by too many, and whose inclusion on the world map or in a global community takes place only by exclusion and a violence knowing no consent? In putting this kind of question to photographic portraiture, I am calling for a deeper understanding of photography's participation and intervention in these movements of inclusion and exclusion, one that would not succumb to the simple polarities of colonial, post-colonial, or anti-colonial categories, and that would not end up, by always shoring up or promoting colonial and imperialist lines of descent for all photography. The photographic portraits of Seydou Keita are, of course, not the neoliberal ones. Taken in Bamako in the 1940s and 50s, they participate in the opening up and dissolution of other orders of exclusion. On the occasion of their recent global recirculation, however, these photographs have become the object of a compelling discourse about the ethical and political work of portraiture, in which the photographer's studio figures as a site or space for the appearance or disappearance not only of certain subjects, but certain forms of subjectivity. Interpreters have thus been able to witness in Keita's photographs, in the words of Laurie Furstenberg, a transfiguration of the African self from object to subject, or to find visible or legible in Keita's photos, in the words of Enwezer, the near disappearance of colonial subjectivity. The promise of Keita's work, then, when viewed against the backdrop of these interpretations, is that it gives us a powerful language for thinking such movements in and out of photographic space. Today in this paper, I'll look more closely at a key moment in the critical discourse about Keita's photographs. This is in the arguments about his poses. I first became preoccupied with these arguments about Keita's poses, or should we call them his sitter's poses, and this is in some sense precisely the question, when I noticed that these arguments seem sometimes to work with, but sometimes against, a larger interpretation of Keita's work as depicting the desire for freedom or vindication of a right to independence on the part of its sitters. I will argue that this interpretation of Keita's photos as depicting their subjects' political, then, as well as aesthetic modernity, although highly compelling, goes astray when it relies on conceptions of human freedom and ethical relation that are ultimately anti-photographic. This anti-photographic impulse to which the photograph of freedom has been submitted comes most clearly into view in the arguments about pose, hence my reason for focusing on those. So let's see if I can get this running. Are you running? You know, what I'll do in the interest of time is just exit and start again so that we can, I think it should go. Yeah. The first portion of my reading is called Collective Demand, Singular Body. Georges Marion, in his review of a CD-ROM of Keita's photographs produced in France in 1995, describes these portraits as constituting a record in the form of personal representations of the denizens of a capital affirming their will to be citizens of the world, expressing a will to signify, represent, and authenticate this transition from the status of a colonized subject to that precisely of a citizen, on the way to free or on the way to being so. Although his language is more flowery, Marion's claim does not ultimately differ from Furstenberg's and Enwezer's cited earlier. But how can a desire for freedom be understood to have been rendered visible or legible in a photograph? How, moreover, to visualize freedom as a desire or a demand that would be precisely collective, the only freedom worthy of the name as a political force? Such interpretations turn on posited connections between self-fashioning or self-determination in front of the camera and the expression of a desire for political self-determination. They also assume an articulation of a collective desire or demand in the image of a radically singular human being, more often than not in the image of a single body. Now I'll slow things down. I hope we can look a bit later at some of these. Before turning directly to the arguments about Poe's, it is worth mentioning the two main gestures of those critics who have sought to articulate political with aesthetic modernity in their interpretation of Keita's work. The first emphasizes elements of what Nicholas Peterson has called, in a very different context, the changing photographic contract. I think this concept is very useful if imported from a different context. The second conceives of the photographer's studio as a site or space of self-fashioning. I'll treat these arguments in radically abridged form. They're related, so in fact I'll speak only about a passage from Mantia Diawara's well-known article about Keita, addressing primarily the changing photographic contract. Both arguments or sets of arguments would subordinate the pose to a larger historical and sociological commentary without ever giving it its due as the true, if somewhat precarious, locus of these photographs' ethical import. Mantia Diawara, in his important early essay on Keita, this was published in Art Forum, locates the modernity of Keita's work and therefore of his sitters in their willingness to initiate the photographic contract on new terms. In Diawara's account, the most basic evidence of modernity, whether aesthetic or political, is in some sense the mere fact that a photograph was taken, and taken, like all studio photographs, at the behest of the subject who commissioned and paid for it. The subject is here constituted as modern by virtue of his or her willingness to enter into the photographic contract on terms other than those governing its colonial predecessors. There is, however, a kind of equivocity as to the photographer's agency and even as to the action of the photograph in this argument. It seems to me this equivocation or equivocity is at once the strength and weakness of this kind of argument. Thus, Diawara writes, "To say that Seydou Keita's portraits tell the truth about the people of Bamako in the 1940s and 50s is in fact to say that his camera made them into Bamakois." He also speaks, this is Diawara, of the role Keita's camera played in giving shape to modernity at the time of its birth in Bamako. This is another way of saying that Keita's sitters are not somehow modern or cosmopolitan first, only to walk into the studio to document this after the fact. Having a portrait taken by Keita, Diawara continues, signified one's cosmopolitanism. It registered the fact that the sitter not only lived in Bamako, but had therefore seen the train station, the big market, Le Marché Rose, and the central prison, and had gone to the movies. In short, it signified that the sitter was modern. It is, as I've said, the strength of Diawara's reading that it calls our attention to the photographic portrait's power to give shape or signify and not just register something that would exist prior to or outside it. A portrait is never just a document, even when it is also a photograph, which is why the portrait has the power to trouble, I would argue, more than any other type of photograph, photography's so-called evidentiary qualities. This is what some of the arguments about self-fashioning and particularly African self-fashioning would allow us to flesh out. Essentially, that fiction may itself always constitute an order of evidence, right? So there's no contradiction involved in these claims that the portraits that are staged with props and costumes and so on and so forth show evidence of something historical. I see no contradiction there. I applaud Diawara's insistence that it is in some sense always the photograph or the passage into photographic space that makes the sitter modern. But this observation alone will never be enough to give us a criterion allowing us to distinguish aesthetic from more general social or political elements of modernity in photography. Missing from Diawara's account, however, or rather moreover, and I think it's symptomatic of what I've just remarked, is any effort to locate the sitter's modernity or so-called cosmopolitanism at the level of the visual field of the photograph. In the movie theater in question, Keita's subjects were as likely to have been exposed to fashion trends as to ideas. Both the cut of a suit or an idea may be modern, and both may enter into the visual field of the photographic image. But it seems to me they cannot do so in the same way. So, to the pose. The pose belongs, let's see if I can, there's a particular image. I will not be doing a reading. I don't have the image with me. That's unfortunate. I probably do have it with me, but not in my slideshow. thank you. I'll go quickly. The pose, it seems to me, belongs to both of these orders. Changeable like a hemline or the width of a lapel, it takes as its matter the physical form of the human body. It is, however, very difficult to change the human body if not in connection with ideas. In the case of photography, it is very difficult and most likely impossible to produce an image of the body without giving rise to ideas about the person connected with that body. Hence the crucial role played by photography and colonialism in the so-called sciences of race and in the production of race more generally as an epistemological and visual regime. The pose does and does not belong to the order merely of the aesthetic or the visual. It can and cannot be located at the level of the image. We cannot see it in the photograph without at the same time seeing something outside it. The pose marks the point at which photography enters, but also surpasses the order of images. As some of you will know, Keita was famous for having invented certain poses, specifically those involving an angled or a diagonal line. Sometimes there are two different diagonal planes, wherein a seated or even a reclining figure is tilted twice, once in relation to the right angles of the two-dimensional frame, a second time in relation to the lens of the camera, underscoring the translation the camera performs of three-dimensional studio space into two. Quite apart from the question of whether Keita was really the inventor of these poses, I think it's a real question. One sees actually similar angles in the Dakarwa school that date earlier, although they've been misattributed as having been influenced in Mama Kassé and Sala Kassé and Adama Silla and some of the other earlier studio photographers working in Dakar. One sees similar angles that have been attributed to an influence that Keita has had on these, again, wrongly attributed. But quite apart from the question of whether he was really the inventor of these poses, the role they have played in the interpretation of his photos is significant. For the critics have sought to ground on the basis of these poses claims for the agency, dynamism, and activity rather than passivity of Keita's sitters, claims for their subjectivity rather than objectification, and still other claims for an active, dynamic, and ultimately agential engagement of Keita's sitters with the photographer and with his camera. This is, to my mind, already to say that the pose comes much closer than any other element or trait of the portrait to being able to carry an ethical and political content. For it is only through this engagement, not only with the photographer and his camera, but ultimately with the photograph, that the sitter both engages and engages with us. If the sitter's engagement could be confined to a simple intersubjective exchange of glances between two people at the moment the photograph was taken, there would quite literally be no photograph, but only an encounter of strangers. Again, the pose is and is not locatable on the order of the image. We discern this when the arguments about pose tip over into arguments about agency. I'll read quickly because I know I have very little time. These are some of the examples in which critics have chosen to do this. Furstenberg, for example, speaks of Keita's unique ability to animate both stage and sitter, reconfiguring the gaze as a medium of agency. While we might be inclined to read this reconfiguration of the gaze as an operation that would be performed with or by the gaze of the sitter, the arguments about pose cause us to focus instead on the role played by our own gaze as spectators in this attribution of agency to the other. I'll skip and just say that I'm very interested, in fact, in the way that there's a whole concatenation of elements that gets mobilized in the name of pose. Decisions about lighting, even the backdrops in Keita, the camera angle, and so on and so forth, can't be, in fact, eradicated from the discussion of pose, right? So when we think it's something as simple as a positioning of the human body, we realize there's an entire technical apparatus that is invoked. Thank you. In keeping with this more complex interpretation of the pose, Elizabeth Bigham interprets one of Keita's well-known portraits of a reclining woman as making the sitter look dignified. And I'm sorry, I don't have this image with me today. She writes, the dignified repose of the reclining subject is magnified by a camera angle that makes her seem to tilt slightly out of the picture plane. Similarly, Claire Bell describes Keita's sitters as, quote, confronting the camera's gaze in the relationship of model to picture plane, emphasizing the use of a diagonal plane that projects the subject beyond the artifice of the studio into the viewer's space. The interest of these comments, to my mind, is their concern to theorize an engagement and even a confrontation of the sitter with the spectator, a confrontation less with our gaze in the sense that we tend to reserve this term for a flat, two-dimensional looking, but with our space, which is here rendered permeable, precarious, and sensitive to touch. To valorize the animation of the sitter's body or the projection of the subject out of the artifice of the studio is to express a desire to save that body from photography, to take it out of the photograph, and to locate it or dislocate it in a space or time that would be other than that of the photograph. Keita's critics are not alone in engaging in this kind of anti-photographic argument. Postcolonial theories of photography have increasingly given rise to a theoretical apparatus that believes that no photography can, in the end, be rigorously respectful of difference unless it can save the body from the myriad mortifications that photography performs. We can talk about this in Q&A. I'm thinking of the very well-known Pinney volume edited by Pinney and Christopher Pinney and Nicholas Peterson, in which a great deal of work is done with Apadurai's famous piece on the subaltern backdrop to try to mobilize and to essentially argue for a more mobile, rhythmic, sonorous conception of photography. I'm somewhat suspicious of these arguments. What I want to emphasize here is the extent to which these interpretations of Keita and these arguments about pose might also push us in the direction of what I myself would consider to be a hyper-photographic ethics. I'll just conclude with a few remarks about what that might mean, which may seem like a jump cut, but I'll just do it, and then you can hold me accountable later. Thanks to decades of important art historical and anthropological work on photography, we know what makes the photographs of Africans taken by Europeans that produced colonialism as a visual and epistemological regime bad, unethical, or violent. But we have no language, or hardly any, yet, for describing photographs that would resist, contest, or transform this regime. It is not enough simply to know or decide that a photograph was taken by a photographer who can lay claim to the same or similar identities as his subjects, be he Black, Malian, Ivoirian, Yoruba, Bamana, etc., in order to account for the visualization of an alternative ethical landscape. Nor is it enough to focus on the margins of identity politics on some affective component of the relationship between the photographer and his subject. This is what has always been so unsatisfying, in my view, about the arguments that would pin our hopes for a new visual regime on feelings like empathy. What I am trying to suggest here is that it is not a priori certain that it is as easy to visualize love, empathy, affinity, etc., as it is to visualize hate. And it is not certain that it is as easy to photograph love as it is to photograph hate or ambivalence, another very common term. My last remark. If we take in Wazer's claims about the disappearance of colonial subjectivity in Keita's photographs seriously, it becomes necessary to ask whether some other sort of subjectivity appears in its stead. Maybe it is only the colonial subject that can appear and disappear in this way. Maybe the so-called postcolonial subject can't be seen or made visible in a photograph in the same way. Maybe its relationship to photography is different, or maybe we would like its relationship to be different. This is at any rate, one way to read what I find most provocative, if still under-theorized, in the arguments about pose in Keita's work. These arguments, I have tried to suggest, are at their least illuminating when they would mistake the position of the human body as expressing some essential truth about the human or about the self connected with that body, when they would mistake, as the critics have done, pose for poise or evidence of self-possession. In photography, the position of a body, when given, in my view, its most illuminating reading, can only ever indicate its relationship to another whose identity is unknown to us and cannot be closed off. Thank you. Just exit this.
you. The next speaker, Aaron Haney, is a visiting scholar at the Smithsonian, whose book, Photography in Africa, is forthcoming from Reaction Books in 2008. The title of her paper, Bringing Art Up to Date, Photographic Modernities in Time.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks, Sylvester, and everyone. I'm looking forward to all sorts of conversations, and I'm pleased that even with the exodus, there'll be a lot of conversation afterwards. And I really liked and appreciated Jennifer's paper because I think there's a lot of resonances between our work. Whoops, how do I do this? Photography is the first of the modern arts that circled the globe. While this has been observed for some time, we are still a ways away from coming to terms with this, both in compiling the histories of African contributions to the larger picture of world photography and assessing photography's impact on modern creativity in West Africa. And this is a 1920s Accra group portrait of art teachers who gathered together for what they called a hand and eye course, and you see the props and the media in which they were working and hoped to, and presumably did teach their students in beginning in the 20s at least, if not before. I draw attention to coastal West African urban photographies in particular for several reasons. First of all, this was an area, in contrast to the situation in many other parts of Africa, that 19th century photography came about as a result of the introduction of the camera and not the advent of European tutelage. Because of the nascent stage of the study of African photographic histories, this is not yet widely assumed. I shall suggest that this is partly because of the lack of attention paid to subjects and the material conditions of photographs, and particularly old photographs that come from private family collections in West Africa, as opposed to those studies which focus on images in European archives. This is evident from the fundamental difference, I believe, in the kinds of collecting practices and the kinds of images preserved in family and institutional collections in Africa, in contrast to those gathered by colonial expats and et cetera. Secondly, for West African cities like Saint Louis, Freetown, Monrovia, Cape Coast, Accra, Porto Novo, et cetera, it's beginning to be possible to trace African and resident photographers' activity in the 19th century. These cities spawned networks of ideas, conditions, practices, technologies, and patronage systems which are fundamentally international in character and scope. One result of this internationalism is the development of early pan-West African photographic conventions and the recognition of distinctive genres of West African, West African photography, some of which I'll highlight here, become a platform on which to survey photography's vast impact on larger artistic production in the region from the 19th century onwards. And I believe that we cannot begin to understand the emergence of other artistic modernisms in West Africa without taking into account the prevalence and portability of photographic images as fundamental to modern visual culture. Thirdly, my studies of photographic collections in southern Ghana, in conjunction with material from European archives, raise the question, what exactly is a photograph? I would argue that based on how the medium is conceptualized in Ghana, the very definitions and boundaries of photography itself are uncertain. The people occupied with keeping old photographs, the subjects and their descendants, etc., may decide to change them in any number of ways. Photographs are held to be valuable artistic and cultural records and venerable objects of beauty. And this is quite apart from the sort of international global circuit which Keita seems to have started, but to which there's been maybe a lot of attention paid, which is problematic in lots of ways. At the same time, people alter the ways in which photographs alter them in ways which can change the aesthetic and even the conceptual grounding of a photograph's realism and indexicality. It becomes apparent from the beginning that people have made these alterations partly because of a photograph's physical instability and fragility in the face of the climate and other disruptions. But it also comes down to an entirely local set of assumptions that upend the notion of photography as a reproducible medium prized for exact replication. In the following examples, some of photography's qualities become utterly disrupted, and its boundaries blur into other media: printmaking, painting, drawing, sculpture, performance, architecture, textiles, and so on. There are a number of photographic genres established early on, and the discernment of these depends on which archive we consider. Some kinds of images enjoyed widespread circulation because photographers traveled from port to port, as you can see here, selling views of towns, ethnic types, and local beauties, and important political events. Ready-made souvenir images that were popular amongst West African casual customers were not necessarily the kinds of images that would have been bought by colonial traders, missionaries, travelers, and so on. The very different nature of the kinds of image circulation fit into Deborah Poole's notion of visual economies, that is, the uneven dynamics of images traveling across distance. And part of this unevenness in access to images is evident in the limited numbers of recognized African photographers' work in European collections. And with this, we can take into account, of course, the other sort of framings in colonial albums and so on of material of, you know, of pictures of Africans, and how that contrasts greatly with how it's presented in private West African family collections. There are two among the many early photographic genres that will demonstrate the depth and complexity of imagery that survive in different forms depending on the source. This is a slide of Kobin Adjian on his way to exile in 1896, a king from Elmina, Ghana. Examples of chiefly authority are often found in colonial archives, which are familiar to us all, illustrate the idea of defeated rulers, treaty signings that consolidated colonial holdings, and portraits of chiefs on their way to exile. By contrast, this image of a Gold Coast deputation to London, they went up to speak in Parliament and convey their grievances, conveys the importance of local political agitation in international perspective. Their portrait, which is, by the way, from a famous London studio, serves to document and represent their actions to the local Gold Coast audience. Overtly political images in Ghanaian families are rare, but those that survive often feature ancestors who played important roles in local politics, whether before, during, or after British rule. Portraits of young women of marriageable age are another early popular genre that emerged from the region. These are portraits possibly on the right from Fred Grant's studio around 1890, and another from a Lagos photographer, which show aspects of representing the elaborate processes of seclusion, education, and the debut of young women eligible for marriage. Now, many of these images contain visual references, which are culturally specific, but the phenomenon has a much larger and a broader resonance across West Africa. These portraits, commissioned by families, were also appealing pictures for the casual colonial collector. Such a person might have stopped by a local studio to buy souvenir images and chosen an image like this, which were more enticing for what was perceived as nudity or partial nudity. These kinds of images are almost unknown now in present-day collections in southern Ghana. They've been removed or hidden by the descendants or owners as each generation passed judgments about dress and cultural practices that eventually fell out of favor. In this case, the reason is often of the "we don't want to seem primitive, heathen, unchristian, uneducated" variety of editing, which is a practice which all families tend to do with their photographs for different reasons everywhere. There's a risk of oversimplifying things with these examples, but I use them here too as evidence to highlight the differences in collections more broadly. Next is to suggest how these discrepancies draw attention to the larger question of how photography describes local modernities in West Africa, wherein artists and viewers change and shape the appearance and status of photographs to bring their ideas of them up to date. This Luderat studio stamp, "May It Live Forever," speaks to the widespread perception of authority, presence, and ideal qualities contained in a photograph. But most old images don't survive the coastal climate in good shape. Esto Perpetua is also a futile hope for longevity of photo studios to survive and fulfill their promises that copies can be had at any time. Some photographers' descendants recall throwing the big, heavy, bulky glass plates into the sea, which is another interesting discrepancy between the Cayta archive and what happened to the majority of photographers working from the 19th century in West Africa. They took up too much space in the house. There is no way to keep a nice, neat archive. And this is, I would say, one reason why people who have old images are, willing to intervene to lengthen a photograph's life because of the material fallibility of the objects themselves and the lack of studio archives. The next examples show how Ghanaian owners have adjusted and recreated their photographs, new and old, to improve the aesthetic and the conceptual dimensions of the images. Portraits from the Wolf family collection in Accra are 19th century examples of photography's interpenetration with other media. On the left is an 1835 painting of Joseph Wolf, which was sent from Denmark to his family in Accra shortly before he died, and it hangs in his family house. Right, a version of it appears, which appears here, seems to be of charcoal and wash, but is referred to as a photograph, and it is held in a different descendant's house. Here this one probably dates to 1890, again, the one on the right, and echoes the format of here, his granddaughter's photograph portrait made at the time. The drawing mirrors the vignette format, the tonal qualities, et cetera, the framing, and both of these images probably adorned the house's walls in the 19th century. And this seems to beg the question to me, what exactly constitutes a photograph? In this case, the categories shift around more than we might expect. Here's a portrait of an ancestor created in a pre-photographic era, painstakingly created for inclusion in the iconography of family portrait photography. Life-size portraits of Wolf's two sons around 1880 have fared very differently because of the photographic processes. Left as a crayon portrait, and I'll sort of skip over this. Taken together, though, this assemblage of family portraits range over 60 years and highlight the problem of impermanence and yet attest to the importance of the medium of photography as an ideal choice for these portraits. So it's sort of curious to me how these two things coalesce. I believe that photography ushered in the emergence of a culture of portrait display in elite family homes, which is possibly widespread along the coast of West Africa, beginning with the earliest of its manifestations. And the interpenetration of media to augment photography's durability is one aspect of this modernity. And we see here it extends far beyond the actions of a photographer. These Cape Coast studio portraits show the installation ceremony of John Abraham and Comenda in 1964. Left is the original print, which is very large, and then on the right is another print, the same size, but which was sort of renewed, filtered, and retouched aesthetically. The negative was no longer available, and so the family hired a photographer to sort of re-photograph it and touch it up. Both images, however, were carefully kept. One was on display, framed on the wall, and the other was carefully kept nearby. At the same time, this portrait signals a conceptual shift. The former represents a portrait of chiefly ascent, and the other is a memorial image of an important ancestor created after his death. One on the left documented a specific moment in time and links the individual to a royal lineage seat. The other becomes a kind of ultimate portrait that represents the personhood of John Abraham and the ranks of family house members. The iconography of this picture has radically changed, but the indexicality relies on the presence of the older picture and not the presence of the person himself. Another way to say this is that technical transformations have altered the appearance of the image, and its renewal has turned this time-bound chiefly portrait into an idealized memorial image. Other photographs undergo alterations that change the subject matter altogether. We have on the left here a man who married quite late in life, remarried, I should say, quite late in life, and you can see his wife has been erased and edited out of the final version. This is a memorial image that was recreated from a quite late wedding picture. The family drove the wife off after a few weeks. It wasn't a long-standing marriage. But here's the nicest picture that they have of the old man. And then here on the right, this is a memorial image of Maku Kueno, who derives from a similar process in which a much older portrait was reprinted to exclude the subject matter entirely. The original featured her together with a large entourage as she was returned to her family after, with all the accoutrements of a shrine initiate. But for the memorial portrait, her family took this image and pared it down and rendering it generalized and but still recognizable. So family members elected to alter versions of old photographs to remember a particular version or vision of a deceased person, something that had nothing to do in this case with an unwelcome wife or with the idea of shrines, you know, some of which would be morally dubious to family members. We recognize that the original portraits were made under controversial circumstances, and even if that controversy was not publicly acknowledged at the time, and the same is true for the new versions, these are commissioned to record important realities, but the family members determine which of these qualities are worth remembering later on. And the remaking of photographs enacts a distancing, an idealization, and a sort of remaking of personal memory. These aspects of adjusting photographs mark photography's changeability, but also point to larger art historical questions about the nature of genres that are also answered in specifically local ways. For instance, there's a longstanding connection that we know about between painting and photography. We know of Anabulu's early portraits and the reference to photographs, yet very little has been written on the nexus of photography and painting more broadly. In the Gold Coast, there was a visiting missionary who, in 1856, took a daguerreotype portrait of the king of Cape Coast, Kweko Ata. These kinds of pictures are unique, tiny little mirrored images which don't allow for duplicates. So while the king was pleased to know that his portrait would travel to England, he also wanted to keep a copy for himself. In the end, he suggested that the image serve as a model for an oil painting, which would be much better suited to his ideal vision. Much later, this portrait of J.M. Cook, based on an old photograph, and this is actually fairly big, about this big, was locked away in a royal family house in Cape Coast. He held the royal stool, but nobody could tell me why this painting was done or why. The scale is obviously much larger than the photographic scale, and the painting also references the model by sticking to black and white. So the question here is, has it entered into the ranks of an honorary photograph? This begs a much larger set of questions. Why would someone emulate the qualities of a photograph and paint? At the same time, photography's shortcomings of durability, scale, and clarity are adjusted by a photograph's owners. The sense of a person in a portrait, that iconicity, and the indexicality, the sense that an object is a physical trace of a person, is both highly valued and it's mutable. So from the beginning of the media, the practices of West African photography have blurred the notions of what comprised the medium precisely. And what I've tried to bring to the surface here is a more complex view of the development of photography as it emerged within West African networks that extended all the way to Europe from the 1840s and beyond. And the changeability of this medium and the ways in which artists and audiences have shaped these creative possibilities over time underlines the sort of collaborative and multi-directional habit of making photographic objects. It wasn't simply African photographers who created these networks of quintessentially modern form. It was photographers, subjects, viewers, and later owners. At the same time that West African family collections of photographs embody important facts, they also intervene in conceptual and aesthetic... They also intervene in conceptual and aesthetic alternatives. Certainly the centrality and ease of commonplace reproduction that is thought key to the very essence of photography do not apply in the same ways. The images that do remain tend to be palimpsests rather than neat copies, and as such, they provide another way to beg the question of what constitutes the very boundaries of the medium. So, sorry for the technical difficulties. Thank you.
Thank you, Erin. Our next speaker is Monique Fowler-Paul, who is a PhD candidate at School of Oriental and African Studies, or SOAS. And she's been writing about contemporary British artists of African descent, and the paper she's going to present to us today is entitled From Primitive to Postmodern, Artists of African Descent in Britain.
Thank you. Please excuse my scratchy voice. I'll try to speak as close to the microphone as I can. Okay. So, to paraphrase or even to quote from Monty Python, and now for something completely different, we're going to move from the continent into the diaspora of Africa and talk about what I've been sort of thinking in my head as alternatives to modernity as an interrogation, and also to talk about African modernity and African identity in quotes, using, in fact, as a starting point, a European or Western model. So I think that's where it's going to really sort of this paper will actually contrast with many that we've seen so far today. We did see, however, see a comparison similar to this in Stephen Wooten's paper, and I wanted to talk about how this moment of when Picasso unveiled his Demoiselle d'Avignon in 1905 was a seminal moment, the invention of cubism for some, and certainly evidence of artistic genius for many, in terms of his innovative appropriation of African and also oceanic art forms, particularly their abstract planes and or abstracted and stylized planes. Much has been written about this piece that we don't need to go into now, but I did want to talk about how cubism and this particular piece, which appropriates African art in some form or another, emerges as a new art form at this time that is supposed to express this modernist ethos of dynamism and change and really somehow a break from the past. That modernism was seen at the time as a break from the past, as something revolutionary. And the... Oh, what's going on? Should I restart? Oh, restart later. Okay, good. Okay, so, well, this then is in contrast to the way that the African artist, you know, if Picasso was this wonderful genius and he borrowed or appropriated these forms, then you might consider the generators of these forms as equally talented and genius. In fact, they were not seen that way. They were seen as sort of, at best, kind of noble savages who labored in innocence of their actual, the aesthetic value of their creations. Instead, these were actual objects that embodied heathen rituals. So there was this real dichotomy. Well, when you look at the piece by Gavin Yonkies on the right, who's a South African artist working in London at the time of the painting, he is taking a much different vision. Instead of the idea of Picasso appropriating and coming up with genius, and then the African artist sort of laboring in some kind of dark and obscure place that doesn't recognize genius when it's there, he's actually used a symbol of eternity to see that the appropriation can go both ways. And this is very important for artists working in the diaspora, particularly for the artists I'm going to speak about today, British artists of African descent, because they were constantly, very often in any case, accused or criticized as being derivative for actually trying to approach modernism in a Western kind of way. It was really a spectacular double standard, and that's something that I thought was important to outline from the start. So the other important thing, too, when I talk about revolution and progress with modernism is the idea that instead of being linear with Yankees, it's more of a circular, you know, infinity kind of motion. So the model that Yankees is proposing here is in itself an interrogation of modernity, in my opinion. Its legends, its privileges to the Western artist, and the patriarchal hegemony itself. It also stands as an intervention that's absolutely, I feel, absolutely necessary for artists of non-Western descent, particularly working in the West, if they're going to be considered to be of equal standing, to be given proper credit for in an ideology, in a modernist ideology that actually attempts to sideline them, marginalize them, and often exclude them as exotic exceptions to the rule. So let's talk about some artists that don't do that. I apologize for the slide on the right. I couldn't find a better resolution, so just pretend you're nearsighted. So we're going to talk about Frank Boland for a moment, and I wanted to discuss, again, I'm thinking about modernity and about the advances in transportation and manufacturing as early as the, at the sort of the end of the British Empire and the beginning of the Commonwealth as kind of the dawn of a more global time. This necessitated the movement of people as well as goods across the globe. Of course, that also happened during the transatlantic slave trade. So that the idea of movement and again, as a result, multiculturalism is a modern idea that dates back to imperial times, but becomes particularly salient in post-colonial times. By the end of World War II, you have the foment of revolution happening in the British Empire, starting in India, and also then, of course, moving across the continent in Africa, particularly in the 60s, as we've already talked about today. And I wanted to reiterate the idea that people in these countries were looking for much more than a political autonomy. They were actively pursuing decolonization of their minds and their society, this marginalization that excluded them from anything that might be modern, and that does relate to the other panelists' papers. For those who relocated to the UK, this history was an integral part of their struggle to eke out a living and a standing for themselves in a racist society. Far from assimilation, their aspiration was to stake an equal claim to the promise of modernism, its progress, its accomplishments, and its proclamation of a new age. So the idea of a single narrative, a monocultural narrative based on societal and cultural hegemony, became untenable for these artists. In between the 40s, 1940 and 1970, there was an unprecedented amount of people coming, immigrants coming into the UK from Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean, these former colonial nations. And their work was often met with skepticism based in racist assumptions that they couldn't be modern because they were exotic and these things didn't fit together. Oftentimes these artists would have repeated exhortations by tutors, art tutors, and critics to represent their exotic national and cultural backgrounds. At the very least, they were marginalized simply because they were not white. Well, Frank Boling, he was born in Bardika, British Guiana in 1936, so it was, in fact, still under British rule at the time. And he came to London in 1950 to complete his schooling, and he studied at the Royal College of Art. His paintings during art school were mostly still lifes and self-portraits. But as he progressed, he became increasingly interested in geometric form and framing. I think this very much reflects the time of his work, particularly he graduated in 1962, and the rise of pop art and minimalism, which I think you can see some of the influences of those traditions in the mirror painting on the left. Also, a lot of comparisons with the work of Francis Bacon. So somebody who was looking to a lot of artists working both in Europe and the US and some of the sort of wider trends and trying to incorporate those into his work. If you look at the work on the left, you don't see British Guiana necessarily. And that was okay by him, but not always okay for other people. In fact, he would see his colleagues, like David Hockney, go on to greater recognition in the 60s, and he was repeatedly sort of told that Britain wasn't ready for an artist of color. And so eventually he made his way to New York City in 1966. And he was still pressured by gallerists and critics to visualize Guyana in his painting, and I think even more so in New York to a certain extent because of the civil rights movement in the 60s and a feeling that he had a sort of obligation to represent where he was from. His painting became more and more influenced by abstract expressionists like Mark Rothko and, of course, Barnett Newman. And now I turn your attention to the work on the right, Who's Afraid of Barney Newman, which is, of course, a play on Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, and Blue. And you can see here a much more a much more abstract and color field type approach. But hopefully, if you squint, you can also make out the topography or the outline of South America at the bottom of the bottom half of the painting. And he says that he could not escape Guyana or black identity at the time. It was constantly referred to in critiques of his work and exhibits. For example, numerous references to Caribbean color values was often how people would bring it in. So he really felt kind of weighed down. And he says, I wanted to read you a quote. He says, "I spent from the late 60s to 70s suffering through the whole nonsense about black art. I used up an awful lot of physical and psychic energy trying to get that together. And I found most of it had nothing to do with my real self." Well, he met Clement Greenberg in 1962, and of course, the influential Greenberg and his circle were helpful in embracing modernism and helping him sort of let go of these feelings of obligation, at least internally. I think externally he still faced them, but he was able himself to say, "Okay, that's not really where I'm interested in going with my work," and. In fact, around about this time, the so-called figural crutches, like this map of South America, disappear in his work, and it becomes completely much more abstract. Another artist worth examining in this context is Aubrey Williams, also from British Guiana. He was born 10 years earlier in 1926, and as a young man, he studied agriculture, and actually spent 2 years living with the Waro Indians in the Amazonian jungle, and that's important as a way for him to identify with a pre-Columbian heritage, much more so than an African heritage. He was descendants of slaves originally brought over from Africa, but of course, because of slavery, those identities were lost, and he really felt that any kind of identification with an African background would be, in his words, false. And he really identified much more personally with a pre-Columbian heritage. He actually left in 1952 after growing political unrest, his friendship with the Indians not putting him in good standing with the colonial government. And he went to Europe to pursue painting, and he settled in London. Eventually, oh no, don't do that. It doesn't like me, and I can't seem to. There we go. No. Okay. So, critics received his painting as an individual appropriation of the style of abstract expressionism. I think, particularly in the painting on the left, you can see echoes of Arshile Gorky and Willem de Kooning, for example. He was actually primarily self-taught. He spent 1 year in art school at Central St. Martin's and decided it was too restrictive. But somebody who had been well-traveled in Europe and well-read and certainly aware of these other artists at the time. But he himself, Williams, has always declared the basis for his oeuvre to be pre-Columbian culture, and that's why you get names like Tawakawima, also Quetzalcoatl. And there are images. I purposely chose this image for its resonances with abstract expressionism. There are some that have a little bit more of a figurative reference to pre-Columbian culture. He also took inspiration, as you can see on the left, from classical music, particularly the symphonies and quartets of Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich. Well, as you might imagine, he was often asked why in the world Shostakovich spoke to him and why he would want to try to paint out of musical inspiration. And he responded with, well, why would Shostakovich want to create music being inspired by Shakespeare or anybody else? If anybody's familiar with the often cited story of Yinka Shonabari being in art school and having his professor say, why are you talking about perestroika? Why don't you talk about African stuff? So very similar. As you can see, this was not a new conundrum for these artists to be in. However, of course, Williams really felt the whole question was superfluous and did what he wanted to do anyway. So Bolling and Williams helped to redefine Western modernism by synthesizing its stylistic trends and formal ideologies with their non-European heritages and their own imaginations. Their bodies of work are formally and conceptually modern, yet at the time, modernity was a concept from which they were originally barred and to which they were initially seen as tangential at best, a sort of postscript to Picasso. I'm arguing that the very existence of these works and their insistence to work in the manner that was most appropriate for them personally has actually amounted to the fact that they didn't pander to expectations to represent their national or cultural origins. They did feel free to draw upon the entire range of artistic traditions at their disposal, as did Picasso, and that this was the kind of intervention that was necessary for their, you know, their sort of admission into the temple of modernism, if you will. In the 1980s, the second generation of immigrants from formal imperial and colonial countries who had been born, raised, and educated in Britain came of age. There was an explosion of new artists and new work, and even media, that tapped into discourses about race and multiculturalism. So modernism had given way to postmodernism, and it encompassed the very paradigm shift for which the predecessors had called. Rather than staking a claim for modernist formalism or ideals, these British artists of African descent attacked an establishment that had denigrated them and their ancestors. They rejected established narratives and supplied new ones. The work on the right is by Lubaina Hamid, who was born in Zanzibar and moved to England when she was just an infant. For Hamid, I think interrogating modernity is about the other story. That is the one that was suppressed by this kind of monocultural, racist, and classist narrative, and also, she argues, sexist. And Lubaina and Hamid seeks to spoil this narrative, basically. She recenters black women and restores their agency. They actively reject the ideological domination of Europe's colonial and post-colonial enterprises. In this case, what she's done is she's appropriated Mary Cassatt's opera paintings, like there's one called In the Box from 1880. And so she refers compositionally to these theater paintings, and in the interest of time, I won't go into it, but I refer you to Griselda Pollock's work on how this visualizes women's place in the new modern world at the turn of the 19th century. And by appropriating the work of Cassatt, particularly the opera setting, Hamid inserts her protagonists, the two black women featured here, into a critical dialogue that concerns modernity, femininity, and agency. I also feel that it's no mistake, it's no accident that they actually look like they're at the helm of a ship. It's a lot about exploration and conquering and the writing of history and the writing of maps themselves, which is where the reference to maps comes in. Chris O'Feely is an artist with whom I'm sure many of you are very familiar. He was born in Manchester, so he was born in the UK to Nigerian parents in 1968, so a much younger artist. And for Chris O'Feely, there's no need to disrupt or protest or reject the meta-narrative. That, for him, has already been done. In fact, his is more of a postmodern embrace that encompasses all of it. And paradoxically, it turns out that the very existence of this kind of work, this kind of embrace, is still a disruption because, of course, it is multivalent and multicultural and multi-narrative, if one can say that. Thank you. So I just want to turn your attention to the Holy Virgin Mary as embracing pop culture in terms of the barrage of images like the MTV generation, a consumer approach to women in terms of the what I always think look like putti that have been formed out of the genitalia from pornographic magazines, and the whole virgin and whore dichotomy, that he creates a black Mary, he is himself actually raised Catholic by a black Catholic, an image of the perfect woman formed from Picasso, the Bible, and porno magazines. So the first modern artists sought to create an entirely new vision that reflected the cataclysmic changes in the world as a result of the technological advances of the Industrial Revolution. Modernity then has been tantamount to revolt. However, it proclaimed a linear progression of development that did not allow for multiple voices or cultures or trajectories. And these artists have actively rejected and or disrupted this narrative promoted by this modernist ethos. In effect, interrogating and even reconstructing modernity in their own images. The work of Bowling and Williams and later Yonkis, Meade, and Ofili effectively subverts assumptions about black artists and black art that seek to limit their participation in modernity and postmodernity. Within a British and larger Western context, these artists' interventions have created an alternative to modernity, both literally and philosophically, smashing the stereotypes along with the barriers that have historically excluded them. Thank you.
Thank you, Monique. And if I could ask the panelists to come to the front of the room also ask you, the audience, that is, for any questions that you might like to pose to them. Well, you know, maybe to get things... Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. The question or comment is not addressed to any specific speaker, but to all of the speakers. And I'm just fascinated by the movement from photography to the more general kind of arts. But one of the things that really interests me is the very language of discussion itself, the language of this discussion, and particularly the last speaker. I can't remember the last Monique, but the South African artist who did work on Picasso. And you were talking about darkness and light, and I'm just really concerned about the very language of art history itself in terms of chiaroscuro, in terms of seeing dark as being bad, especially when you think of the dark room. The dark room is where the photographer develops the work.
It is a dark room.
It is a dark room. So how could it be a horrible place? And the very language of photography itself, development. You develop an image. It could be underdeveloped. It could be overdeveloped. So the implications of civilization itself in terms of development and this chiaroscuro relationship in terms of light and dark, I'm just concerned that Africans probably need to watch their language. That's it. Thank you.
Shall we
take other?
Well, I think what I would say is simply that it's the subjective vocabulary is a very problematic one for Africanists, always has been, and that in the interest of time, as Kinsey had earlier mentioned, I wasn't able to deconstruct as much as I might have liked the terminologies like light and dark and primitive and heathen and those various terms.
May I say something? I don't think this is a direct response to the question, but in the work that I've been doing on different photographers, it does seem important. I don't know about light and dark, but there are always discussions of different kinds of light in photography from a technical point of view. So you start talking to a photographer about his or her work. It's not about light and dark. It's about different kinds of light. And, you know, in Keita's case, some of the famous lines from the interviews that get picked up and cited, you know, are always about his preference for natural light over artificial light. And, you know, so there are all these different dichotomies and hierarchies that almost immediately get instilled, right? But it's always this discourse. I think one could never escape a discourse of light in a discussion of photography. And, you know, what you raise is very interesting to me as someone working on photography for that reason, right? You know, is this a technology of light, and what are the consequences of continuing to think of it that way, or the practice? Right, right. I this point is not lost on me, right? But it would be interesting to talk to a photographer, you know, about a different way to conceive of the apparatus itself. It's very small.
Yeah, I have two questions. I mean, I really liked how the first two papers work together in a way. Mm-hmm. As a historian, they should have been in the opposite order, but it still worked. And I guess my first question to Jennifer, and I've seen a lot of these Seducator images in museums. They're not very, you know, and conferences, they come up very often. And in the large literature that must exist about him, has anybody ever talked with his quote-unquote sitters or with the people he actually photographed? Mm. Because, you know, it's not that long ago, so I'm sure some of them are still alive. Yeah. And
do you know the answer to that? Because
Shall
I let you finish? Or?
Yeah. Well, I have another question, so perhaps then you both can answer it together. And so, which just kind of leads me to Erin, because in my own work, I also worked on southern Ghana, but I worked on kind of non-elite settings and kind of conducting life history, doing life history style research of non-elite men. I've noticed that clerks, teachers, and so, they all have photo albums going back to the beginning of the 20th century. And talking with them about these photographs, I really realized how much having these photographs is so much part of their self-styling, self-representation. So it's not just this elite setting, you like the Wolf family, but also a very different kind of class, which kind of made me think, I'm sure this is might be another way to get an approach to what these pictures meant to Seducator's subjects or to his sitters.
Keita is such a funky case. You think the literature would be vast in an informative way, but it's not. And unlike in the case of Sidi Bey, for example, who was his contemporary, roughly, in which I have heard those kinds of conversations, right, with sitters and people in the community who are saying they still remember where going to the studio and what it was like and so on. It seems to me that in the Keita discourse, everything was... It's totally monolingual. It's or you know, it's a monolingual discourse between André Magnin and Keita, and all of those sort of gnomic utterances that were first laid down in those early interviews have become the basis of the literature, which is essentially no literature. I feel I can be polemical in part because Erin opens up. You know, there's a reason to critique. You know, the centrality of Keita or the mixed blessing of his function as say a gatekeeper in this new phenomenon of the voguish global recirculation, but the discourse is strangely, pure of any kind of ethnographic or social situation of the work. Now, we have some of these same scholars working on other photographers in which that's not the case. So, I'm not writing a book on Keita, right? He serves as a kind of... he's a marker, right, of a reason for engaging this material now in a radically different way from the way I feel it has been engaged. But I don't know of any existing references. Now, there are other West African photographers who are quite well known, whose work has not been shown in the Met, you know, about whom these kinds of questions and these kinds of explorations have been asked and begun, but not in his case as far as I know. It's a conspicuous,
Not necessarily about the Keita question, although I agree with your whole larger point about there sort of being a literature of nothing, and it all derives from Magnin and the whole collection. And, you know, it's an interesting set of questions, but it sort of keeps going around in the same circle. and doesn't get very far. And with regards to Ghana and that whole connection, I don't mean to privilege Ghana. It's simply that I, you know, have done a lot of work there, and the fact of its early fluorescence, you know, in the 19th century, and the sort of democratization of it, at least along the coast, as far as I can tell, in terms of how people present themselves to you. You know, when you go and visit a house, you know, there is a presentation of albums and images, and I'm not sure to what extent it's true in different parts of West Africa. I've heard anecdotal evidence, you know, one way or the other, but how is that different from China or, you know, rural United States or whatever else? But the fact of its early establishment in, you know, in coastal communities, and whether, you know, there was only elite people that could afford it, but, you know, it became such a widespread phenomenon early on is interesting to me, and it allows for another, you know, a sort of, you know, more possibility for how do people perceive and talk about and consider photographs, and I think that needs to be addressed, and it hasn't come up in the literature on photography more generally, because we have been focused on the beautiful image and its presentation in the Met, so...
I don't want to be a hug. I remembered having this extended discussion with Ogwebe about the significance of the Keita archive. Why Keita? And the reason why I asked Ogwebe that question is because, you know, he knows the depth of the photographic archive that exists in southern Nigeria. And he kept coming back to that issue that the Keita archive, it's because of the quantity of the archive. So I asked Enwezo that same question. What is significant about the Keita archive, which you cannot replicate in the, you know, works of about 100 photographers in Ibadan alone that I know by name and, you know, remember their practice as a young boy? And he moved around that same question, that somehow that Keita fashioned a self-identity, an active, you know, holding of material. And I don't see that. What I see with the Keita issue is that he got there first. And that getting there first is now locked, you know, the emerging discourse of African photography into this very unfortunate sort of sacrilegious, you know, worship, as it were, of a notion of practice of the unique individual who creates. And all the other areas of African artistry have actually been moving away from that idea, as artistry in general, but it becomes, it's a very, very ethnographic, ethnographically void idea of cultural practice, which is problematic.
That may have been true at the outset, but I think part of the continuing, you know, focus on him is the controversy that surrounded his archive and what happened to it with Pagazzi, and I think, well, not entirely. I think it's getting there is one thing, but staying there to the degree that it has, I think it's been fueled by the controversy. And when Sean Kelly did the last show of Keita's work last year, the review in the Times was not about Keita's work. It was all about the controversy. And I think that was very significant because it was a marketing ploy. And I thought very clearly and deliberately, and I talked about that to Sean. And it was, yeah, and so it's, I think it's not just a matter of first.
That, you know, because it turned a collection that he picked up within a period of 10 years from, you know, a $500,000 collection at best into a $20 million, you know, Sotheby's sale. So there is an issue there. What I'm saying is, look, what I'm saying about Keita is not that he's not a significant photographer. It is that the nature of his presence does, you know, as you said, it has to do with controversy, but merely because he keeps getting replicated, you know. There's already the show, so you pick some pictures from there and you show it somewhere else. And,
You know, let's take a couple of other questions, and then we'll be able to continue the conversation over lunch. So I believe Christian had his hand up.
My name is Christian Roma. I'm a Swedish art critic and working with Evelyn Ekudebos. I was very satisfied with the whole panel here. About Keita, what really impresses me is the presence he gives his humans. Mm-hmm. And I think he does it with two ways. One, more formal. I would call it black skin and white flowers. And I would say it is like you had a lake with white flowers there and somebody coming from up through the flowers. That is a fantastic space construction which makes that they come like this. Then I feel that there is also a kind of psychological contact with the photographer. I really feel that I hear a very soft voice from Keita. I don't know if I am right, but it's not often that you in photography can see such a trust with those people who are photographed. And those two things together creates a very specific presence. So, I mean, the poses, I don't think they are so important.
Maybe Skip and then John. But I think Skip. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Aaron.
Yeah. Thanks.
That was a fantastic paper.
Oh, cheers.
It showed us all the extent to which one can find out how unmysterious things are in history if you actually go to the source of the archive. Which brings me to Jennifer, and what I felt was like almost a disdain in your voice at the beginning of your paper about, I don't have a field. I don't think that that's really what you meant, but I think that if you're going to begin like that and conclude with, we can ultimately not know, I think that what you should do before you start saying things like that is actually go to where the source of the archive is. Interview these people who are around. You might actually come up with something as interesting as what Aaron came up with.
May I address the critique?
Otherwise, you're just reproducing what's in like a couple of books, as you've already mentioned, that have been written by people who have also not gone and looked at that archive.
May I respond very quickly, because I think Peter wants us not to talk only about Keita. I have no intention of not doing fieldwork. I, in fact, finally have funding to do fieldwork in several sites in West Africa, but I'm not interested in doing fieldwork on Keita. I'm interested in doing fieldwork on other photographers. So when I said I don't have a field, that wasn't meant to say I have no interest in going. That was not a statement dismissive of the kind of work that Aaron has done. In fact, I very much hope to do that kind of work. And I feel I feel quite inspired by work like hers to continue to work on photography in a way that I think would still nonetheless not be bound by the field and the area studies model. So that's I want to see theories of photography more generally be informed by readings of this work. That's all I want to see. And when I say I have no interest in doing field work on Keita, it's not because I don't think there's work to be learned or things to be done there. I'm actually more interested in other photographers. And it is that that gateway effect and certain kinds of readings that have been enabled by this phenomenon of his mediatization and, you know, star power, that I'm actually trying, I'm interested in how that's functioned, but I actually have a very critical relationship to it myself. So I don't know if there's any disdain, it's not for people who do the kind of work that Aaron does. It's for certain parameters that have been placed on the conception of what the work is to be done.
So maybe Skip, if you have a final comment.
I'm not well read in studies of photography in West Africa, but Keita's work in particular strikes me as the sitters become, and the photographs become mask-like, in the sense that the gentleman behind me spoke of, the sense of dislocation and location. The sitter is herself and she is not herself. The image is forever fixed, as a mask is forever fixed. And the image reeks of a kind of paradox and ambiguity in the same way that a mask does. So I'm just curious to know if anybody has interrogated photographs in Africa or elsewhere with the vocabulary that one might use to discuss traditional masks.
I haven't found that at all in my conversations with photographers. People speak of recognition, and they speak of gesture and performance and things that tend to do more with sort of everyday phenomenon of presenting themselves in a certain way in a public event or a public occasion. So I think it tends to do more with ideas of spectacle and interaction in a social setting. From the little bit that I've spoken with photographers and can try and pull as much as I can an aesthetic language or a descriptive and aesthetic language out of them. But they're very hesitant, the people that I've spoken with, which aren't very many. No, I see your point. Right. No, but I think there is a resonance there in that people do present themselves in a very specific way. You know, there's a way of sort of cooling your face and sort of presenting your body language and your face in a way that, you know, you could describe it as mask-like, or you could say it's just a general social nicety that one does. And, you know, again, coming from a...
My suggestion is different from that.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Well, yeah. Maybe we could leave it at that and continue the conversation over lunch. And thank you both to the audience.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.